Okay, I'm going to call the February 13th meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes of the February 11th meeting of our committee. Would anyone who has read them like to move approval? Representative Elkins moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. So, Representative Lee, are you, not to put you right on the spot right when you walk in, but that's what I'm going to do. So, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3056.
Sure. And this will, and it will be moved to the Capital Investment Committee? That sound correct?
Yes.
Okay. So Representative Lee moves House File 3056 to the Capital Investment Committee. Please present your bill, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have an author's amendment, the D2 amendment. I'd like to move that too.
Okay. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like it?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Is there Representative Lee moves the DE2 amendment? Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay. All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Lee, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 3056, as amended, is a bill that adds equity hiring goals to state bonding projects. Currently, when a state agency seeks bids from contractors for goods and services of at least $100,000 a building project, the agency cannot award a contract unless those contractors have a diversity hiring plan affirmative action that has been approved by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And certificates apply only to contractors that have more than 40 full-time employees and they last for 4 years at a time. This law has been on the books for decades in the contracting and labor world, and this isn't really new. And hundreds of contractors in every corner of our state currently have certificates and already comes to working with the department. My bill, as amended, extends the Department of Human Rights' current workforce goals and equal pay protections to general obligations, GOs, bonding projects. With equity in bonding, we can recognize the many benefits bonding projects bring to local communities, create more career opportunities for people of color, people with disabilities, and women, and ensure workplaces are equitable and inclusive, free from discrimination. Mr. Chair, members, this bill is crucial because Minnesota thrives when state investments are used to intentionally undo disparities and inequities for people of color, women, and people with disabilities. And with that, okay. Open to questions, and I believe the Department of Human Rights is here too.
Sure. Why don't we take testimony first, then we can move to member questions. So is Commissioner Lucero here?
Yeah. Morning.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Farberg. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. It's good to be back. Welcome back to session.
Good to have you here, Commissioner.
Thank you. Okay, well, as Representative Lee mentioned, you know, since 1985, state law requires the Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights to issue workforce participation goals for women and people of color on state-funded projects. What this means is that the legislature has identified the importance of being intentional about ensuring we are creating a welcoming and inclusive workforce to all Minnesotans. The legislator said, hey, if we're going to be spending millions of dollars in Minnesota, let's make sure we're doing it intentionally to align with our values of creating a thriving community. In 2013, the legislatures again reaffirmed this commitment to ensure we are creating a world that's inclusive and equitable by passing the Women's Economic Security Act. This act requires employers to ensure they are paying men and women the same rate for the same job. Legislators, you mandated that the Minnesota Department of Human Rights enforce the act through now equal pay certificates as well. So I'd like to just talk about how great this is working out. And one great example of this project is the partnership between our department and J.E. Dunn on the Capitol Restoration Project, just across the street and one of the largest recent construction projects in Minnesota. On that project, the company exceeded the workforce participation goals with 35% people of color working on that project and 21% for women, one of the largest numbers for women ever in Minnesota on a construction project. So J.E. Dunn partnered with local nonprofits. We helped facilitate and have those conversations to bring more people of color and women into the industry on the project. One thing that's important to note is that J.E. Dunn was able to keep those employees past the project. So more than 80% are still in trades today. This state project did more than renovate a historic building. It helped bring historically disenfranchised communities into well-paying careers. So being intentional matters, and it really makes a difference. That's why we strongly support Representative Lee's bill, House File 3056, to extend workforce goals and equal pay protections to local governments receiving funding for general obligation bonding projects. So let me provide an example of why this is important. The Rochester Civic Center and the renovations of the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center, DEC, were two important projects for Minnesota funded in part with bonding money. Because the funding for these projects ran through the cities instead of state agencies, the contractors are not required to make any good faith efforts in achieving their workforce participation goals for women and people of color on those state funded projects. So not being intentional matters, and it makes a difference. So that was a missed opportunity to work towards the thriving community we're all trying to create. So moving forward with this bill, we have an opportunity to provide this kind of intentionality to projects funded by general obligation bonding projects. It's a really easy lift. We have 3,800 contractors across the state that are already complying with these on certain projects. So this would simply be an expansion of work that's already occurring. I really want to thank Representative Lee, all the bill sponsors, city and county associations, and other stakeholders on their collaboration to help make sure this process is easy and understandable. Our department, of course, looks forward to continue working with you on ensuring we're creating a Minnesota that's free from discrimination and creating equitable outcomes wherever we can. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone else who would like to testify regarding House File 3056? Okay. Seeing none, member discussion. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not really sure either one of you can answer this, but I'm just having some concerns considering that some areas have a real work shortage. Mm-hmm. So would there be some considerations to maybe some other areas of the state where maybe they're not meeting simply because the folks aren't there to hire? Yeah.
Commissioner Lucero?
Yeah. Chair, thank you so much for your question. So I think that what's really important is that this is a bill about being good partners with contractors that are already doing this work across the state. This is actually about increasing workforce, increasing the pipeline, and making sure that we can help increase workforce across the state.
Okay, Representative Tice?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testifier. Is there any dollar limit? It looks as if any subdivision now, which would be a county or local government, would have to comply with this, right? And is there any dollar limit that a minimum that people that they or companies they would contract with would be exempted from this, or would it be everybody down to the first dollar?
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Sessioned. It's back.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Vogel, thank you. Thank you for that question. So, yeah, this applies. The workforce goals specifically apply to projects that are over 100,000, and the equal pay goals are specifically related to projects over 500,000. And so it's specifically for your bigger projects that are in place.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. So those limitations apply. So if a county was, say, working with the Soil and Water Conservation District, and they decided that they needed to work with a farmer to do $50,000 worth of work, even though the money was coming through the bonding that eventually got to them, they'd be exempted because those limits would apply and you wouldn't put an unnecessary burden on maybe some small contractor that would have difficulty then, correct?
Commissioner Lucero.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, your goals are admirable, and I like the words that you said about increasing workforce. I don't know if Northern Minnesota is unique or maybe it's not, but our part of the state is really lacking in workforce. I mean, it's something I hear from our builders all the time. They're aging. They're looking for young workers to train. It's almost impossible to have a project of any size now because of the lack of workforce. But here's my concern. We only have a few contractors in greater Minnesota that are able to do these large projects that are equipped and able and so on. And we don't have great diversity, you know, and I don't know what exactly the diversity goals look like here. Yeah. But So my question is, are these goals or requirements?
Yeah.
And is there, I mean, so what does a contractor do if they, you know, they have certain goals, they can't meet those goals, then what's the out for them to still have the funds to do the project?
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, I will attempt to answer this question, and then if I'm missing anything, the commissioner could add on to this. So these are just goals, and they're not mandates, and the Department of Human Rights will be working with the contractors for best faith efforts in trying to reach those goals. And also, just regarding the different goals for the different regions, and I believe inside your package there's a map that has the different goals for the different regions of the state.
Representative Lehman.
Thank you. I appreciate that answer. Thank you.
Is there any additional member discussion? Ranking Member Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for the commissioner. You referenced Duluth and Rochester. So what were the percentages there?
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair, thank you, Representative Kwan. Now, the percentages for those specific projects, is that what you're asking? Yeah. So, Representative Kwan, the point is that they didn't have to have any workforce goals to be working towards, and so we want them to be working towards those goals. So I'm not sure if they had any more local ones, but there were no workforce goals from the state.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the commissioner is indicating they're not aware of a problem. They're just looking to prevent that there might possibly be a problem. I know Duluth is below the state average for diversity. At least when I was on an education committee, there was an average percentage of population in major areas, and Duluth was below and Rochester was above. And there are 100 different languages spoken in the homes of the students in that school district. And so that I was just curious then, you know, you brought up the two, what the percentages were. You know, it'd be nice to know if you're wanting to change or expand, if there's a problem there, and plus looking at how do we help you know, the businesses in different parts of the state, because frankly, I know a lot of parts of the state that it's hard to find a worker. And having been on a school board, when you bid out a project, you get X number of entities bidding, and some of the smaller municipalities probably have, you know, they're lucky if they get two, you know, different people bidding on some of these projects. So it'd be nice to understand the global aspect when we change the landscape. And that's just why I was curious.
Yeah. Before you respond, Commissioner Lucero, I'd just like to draw members' attention. There are two handouts from the Department of Human Rights. They were inadvertently placed in the packet related to House File 3103. So I just want to make sure members' attention is drawn to that. Commissioner Lucero, did you have a response to Representative Kwam's question?
Yeah. Thank you, Chair. Representative Kwan, at the end of the day, Minnesota is going dramatically more racially diverse. We're also aging very quickly, and so we know that we have to do things differently. And so this provides the intentionality and support and partnership with cities, counties, and contractors to make sure that we're all being really intentional about how we're working to achieve workforce goals. And so I hope it's a deep partnership that we're talking about here.
Representative Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting us know where the reference material was and wasn't.
Any additional member? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lee, for bringing this forward. Looking around the table, Representative Lehman and Representative Salk, and I always want to say Vogel, I think you were on last session, but we're all on, and Representative Lee, you're the Vice Chair of Capital Investment. So we've been all over the state of Minnesota, and you can really see, you know, and this map kind of brings it out, but it's good that you're focusing on that and on these issues and making a good effort on these projects. So thank you for your work in human rights and the governors.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Any additional member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, community members, for the discussion. I really appreciate all of you taking you know, look at this and really see how could we as a state of Minnesota start looking at really addressing some of the inequities that we have with regards to when we invest state dollars into this. And so I just want to say thank you for taking the time to hear this.
Thank you, Representative Lee. With that, Representative Lee renews his motion that House File 3056, as amended, be referred to the Capital Investment Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. I believe Representative Moran is here. I think we will take your bill next. And that is House File 3103. I will recommend, I will move that House File 3103 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. And you have an author's amendment. Did you want to take that first?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Get the bill in proper form.
Okay, so I will move House Amendment A1 in your packet to put it in the form the author would like. Is there any discussion to the amendment? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Chair Moran, would you like to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chair. Chair.
Yes.
thank you for the opportunity to be coming before this committee to introduce this bill, but also share some information about the bill and hopefully educate some. So there's a group called the Crown Coalition. So this bill is titled Crown, but what it means is creating a respectful and open world for natural hair. It was launched as an effort to change societal biases and discrimination against African-American women and men, and that would also include girls and boys, natural textures and hairstyles. According to the Crown Research Study, completed in 2019 by the Joy Collective, it found that African-American women are 80% more likely to change their natural hair to meet Eurocentric standards of appearance, social norms, and expectations at work. They also found that 50% of African-American women are more likely to be sent home or know of an African-American woman who was sent home from the workplace because of her hair. 30% of African-American women are more likely to receive a formal grooming policy in the workplace. So the Crown Coalition was co-founded by Dove, we all know Dove, the National Urban League, Color of Change, and the Western Center on Law and Poverty, and is supported by over 50 other NGOs and nonprofits. So I think you guys have seen, maybe, lately that these bills have been moving across the country. In July of 2019, the Crown Act was signed into law in both California and New York. New Jersey became the third state to make the Crown Act law in 2019, and the bill has also been introduced in Congress, in both the House and the Senate. Locally, we have the Urban League, Twin Cities, and the Council of Minnesota of African Heritage, and the City of St. Paul African American History Month Committee, who are all supportive of this bill. And so the draft language that was drafted by the House Research, it was modeled after the New York legislation. And what I found just the other day from the Department of Human Rights, the original language in the bill was to expand the definition term of race, but I found out we didn't have a definition of race in the state of Minnesota. So what the amendment did, and the correct language would be, that race is inclusive of traits associated with race, including but not limited to hair textures and hairstyles, such as braids, locks, and twists. So that's some of the background information about this bill.
Okay.
And I have here Commissioner Lucero to speak a
sure.
bit more about the importance of this bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Moran. I do have, yeah, we did. Yeah, the amendment's been moved. I do have seven people on the list who want to testify, and there's another bill after this, I know, too, with some testifiers. So to the extent you can keep your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes, that would be, and just for all the testifiers, that would be appreciated. So if you could please, I know you just spoke, but just for the record, if you could please identify yourself once more, it would be helpful.
Thank you, Chair. Again, hi, good morning, everyone. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Department of Human Rights. And I will be brief. But by now, we've all heard the story of DeAndre Arnold. This is the 18-year-old kid from Texas who's excited to graduate this May. But a recent change in the school's dress code policy requires DeAndre to cut his dreadlocks to walk at graduation. So that's getting a lot of press right now. But this is not at all a unique story. Since long before the beginning of this country's existence, black hair has always been something that is both officially and unofficially regulated, and black women in particular are unfairly impacted. This is not a unique story here in Minnesota either. A couple years ago, an employer here in Minnesota changed their work policy around hair. Showing up to work the next day after the policy was changed, all the black employees at this work site were told of the policy change, and they were told that their natural hairstyles of locks and braids and knots were no longer in alignment with the new policy. They were told, you either need to cut your hair or that you will be fired. Several insisted on maintaining their dignity by refusing to cut their hair. They were fired. They came to the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. In this situation, our office was able to intervene and reach a settlement with the employer that required that employer to rehire those employees and that racially discriminatory practice and ensure that doesn't happen again with that employer. But we know this continues to happen every day in schools and workplaces. This discrimination against natural black hair violates an individual's dignity and humanity, and it violates what I hope our values are here in Minnesota. So our department strongly supports the Crown Act because black Minnesotans have the right to style their hair in natural styles without fear of discrimination. And while race discrimination is already prohibited under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, this bill provides the plain language clarity to ensure that when we're talking about race, that we're including hairstyles inherent to racial identity. So as Minnesota's very own civil rights enforcement agency, we are dedicated to undoing racial disparities, ensuring Minnesotans can lead lives with dignity and joy, and ending discrimination. So thank you, Representative Moran, the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, for their leadership on this important issue. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Commissioner. The first, I think I'll just go through testimony. I have a couple of members who want to speak. If it's okay, I'll just take testimony and then call on the members who are on the list. So the first testifier I have is Meredith Moore Crosby. Welcome to the committee. If you could just please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, Chairman Freiberg and Vice Chairman. My name is Meredith Moore Crosby. I'm a resident of Mendota Heights. I'm born and raised here in Minnesota. And I just wanted to share with you that at a very young age growing up here, I was told that my natural hair texture that I'm wearing today was not only not professional, but was unacceptable throughout my time getting jobs, starting from my first one here. I had to leave to attend a historically black college and university, Howard University in Washington, D.C., where I first felt comfortable to wear my natural hair. And I actually had to write an article about it in the newspaper because immediately my sexuality was questioned, my ambition was questioned, my identity was questioned. And I think it's important as a Minnesotan, I understand that we have such a learning opportunity for us to share how we experience the world. And so for me, I just want to share that as a leadership coach, I now work with women who want to advance into the highest levels of leadership in our corporations, not only in Minnesota, but around the country. And this is a real issue they struggle with. Do I need to change my identity to get a job? Do I need to change my hair and identity to advance in that job? And am I being a good role model if I decide to stand up and be different at work? And so I thank Representative Moran for allowing me the opportunity to share my experience, and I thank you for listening to me today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Lee H. Gordon, Jordan, excuse me. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
All right. My name is Lee Henry Jordan. I am the Midwest and State National Director for Juneteenth And if I don't know if all you are familiar with Juneteenth and how important it is. So this, the Crown Act, is very, very important to our culture, to our heritage. And this year for our Juneteenth celebration, we are surrounding with our youth program on giving our youth the self-esteem that they need to identify themselves and to be who they are no matter what is put before them. And so it's important to us that this act is passed and we move forward with what needs to be done for our children. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for your work with Juneteenth. Next up, I have Steve Belton from the Twin Cities Urban League. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Stephen Belton. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of Urban League Twin Cities, formerly the Minneapolis Urban League. I'm delighted to be here today and really delighted that Representative Moran and you are taking up into consideration this very important bill. The Crown Act is part substance and part symbol. The substantive part you've heard very articulately and eloquently spoken by Meredith and by Mr. Jordan, but you also need to know that it is also about a symbol. It's about a symbol that for African descendants in particular, that our identity, our culture, our way of presenting ourselves, that it matters and that it is valued, and that the state of Minnesota is willing to put its legislative oomph and power behind saying that we will protect your right to be who you are. So it's not simply the cases that you've heard about in the media. There are cases like DeAndre Arnold, but also Andrew Johnson. Many of you have probably seen the YouTube video of that young man having his dreadlocks cut while he stood on the floor of his wrestling match because he was told he could either have his hair cut or he could forfeit the match. That was a viral YouTube. But there was also Faith Finity in Louisiana, an elementary student who was sent home and told that her braids, just braids, violated the school policy. Ironically, the archdiocese of the school where she attended said that they valued only, that students could only wear natural hairstyles. She was wearing braids. And so it's been examples like that, but I would caution you not to think that that's just Texas and Louisiana and New Jersey in the case of DeAndre Arnold. No, this is here as well. This is all over, and this is really a mindset. Marcus Garvey, many years ago, around the turn of the 20th century, said, don't remove the kinks from your hair, remove them from your brain. And what this law would do would be to remove a kink from the brain of Minnesota practice and culture. And so we're asking that you support passage of the Crown Act. Everyone deserves their own crown of glory, and that crown of glory begins with representing who you are authentically in the workplace and at school. And no child should be sent home, no adult, and particularly African-American woman, should be denied a promotion or denied an opportunity, or in the case of some who have had job offers extended to them and then have them rescinded because the applicant, the person who received the offer, refused to cut their braids or change their hairstyle. This is an impermissible practice, and it should not be allowed to occur in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Belton. Next, I have Jasmine Carey from the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, committee members. Thank you for having me today. I am testifying on behalf of the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage. We are asking you to support the Crown Act today. The Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage was implemented to advise the governor as well as the state legislature on issues that impact people of African heritage in Minnesota. As we know, our state has some of the highest racial disparities in the country for people of African heritage. In order to address these disparities, the solutions implemented need to be intentional and equitable. Around the legislature, I've worked in state agencies here, we all talk about eradicating disparities, getting to the barriers. This is a solution before you today that does just that. You hear the personal testimonies we have people call. I, as a woman of African heritage who's grown up in Minnesota, who's worked in the state, who's worked in the city, who's worked in corporate, this is something that I have to prepare for and deal with every day. From finding products to, I joke with friends, we have interview wigs. Like, it's not something that that a lot of people are aware of, but it's something that we go through. And this is a clear solution. It's been passed in 3 states. We have several states who are trying to get it passed now. We can be on the cusp of something great in Minnesota before the federal legislation is instituted. And I think if we have that rigor and we have that drive to address disparities like we say we do, I think this is a clear solution to help get to that and get us on the right path to doing something for people of African heritage in our state. Thank you so much for having us here today.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yeah, if you could. Yes, yeah. Sorry. My name is Jasmine Carey, and I am the Policy and Legislative Director for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage here at the state.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I have Gwendolyn Barber, Co-Director of Eco Hair Association.
Oh, she's okay. Not here.
Then I have Linda Garrett Johnson on the list. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Linda Garrett Johnson, and I live in the city of Apple Valley. And I just wanted to tell you briefly my own story with dealing with my natural hair. One morning I woke up to do what I normally did. About 2 years ago, I took a shower, washed my hair, blow-dried it, and went to comb it and found it falling out in the sink. It was falling out in the sink because I had flat ironed it or straightened it, as we call it, for many, many years. And I had a decision to make at that point in time. What do I do? Do I go to work and continue to flat iron my hair and probably end up bald, or do I start to wear it naturally? I was petrified. I worked in corporate America at the time for a very, very, very large healthcare organization. And I thought to myself, what are my coworkers, my colleagues, my boss going to think when I walk in that day with my hair looking like it does right now? I washed my hair. I figured out a way to do it because I hadn't worn it naturally before. As black women, we are taught to feel like wearing our natural hair is something to be ashamed of. So we cover it up by flat ironing it to make ourselves look like our, I hate to say it, but our white counterparts. I was ashamed walking into my place of business with my hair naturally because I thought, what's going to happen? I didn't know if there was a policy to wear my hair naturally or not. I had no idea. I had worked there for 10 years and had no idea as to whether or not I was going to have some kind of a problem walking into my place of business, which, I worked for 10 years, and whether they were going to be upset with me wearing my hair naturally. Luckily, nothing happened to me. I have to say, though, a lot of my colleagues looked at me and they were trying to figure out what to say about my hair, whether to comment, whether to compliment me or what. They weren't quite sure what to make of me. But what I do want to say as well is right now I'm no longer working for that business. They didn't let me go, so nothing like that happened. But what I'm in business for myself now as a consultant, and I do think about whether or not when I go out to try to get contracts, what's going to happen to me. I have a contract. I'm in negotiations right now for a large contract with the state, and I wonder to myself, when I actually go in and meet with those folks, are they going to say, we're not sure if we want to hire her because of what she looks like? So I want to let you know that this is real. It's a real thing, and I'm really thankful for the committee to consider this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Garrett Johnson. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 3103?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Naya Bingi Selassie, and I am a student at Irondale High School. And I just wanted to talk about my experience with discrimination against my hair at school. So last year, I was on the school play, but one day I was pulled aside to be asked, what are you going to do with your hair? I don't want it getting out of control on stage. She looked directly at my hair as she said that. Now me, being one of the four black people actually allowed into the play, I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to say, so I just said, I don't know, I'll figure it out. Then I walked off. I can't imagine that happening to me in the workplace, but it still does happen to so many women of color, so many men of color in Minnesota. Or even worse, people get fired for wearing their natural hair. I can't fathom that happening to me, me being pretty much forced to flat iron or relax my hair to be deemed professional or beautiful in the eyes of the beholder. But it does happen. I remember being little, me being mixed. I didn't know. I didn't really think of myself as black. I looked at my mom thinking, dang, I wish I had straight hair. After a few years, like for the past few years, I've been embracing my natural hair and my culture. And I feel like that is so empowering for the women and men of 2020 for this to be able to happen here in Minnesota. In so many other states, this has been happening. Like, a bill like this has been passed. So, yeah, I just feel like it's really necessary. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, I'll close testimony and move to member discussion. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Moran. I think we were all appalled by the young man that had to have his hair cut just to be in a wrestling tournament or to go to graduation. I mean, that is, in 2020, that is absolutely appalling. So thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Gomez, did you? Okay. Representative Heinrich?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to maybe ask Commissioner Lucero a question, if she's still in the room.
Yep. While she comes down, feel free to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I just had a question more in regards. Actually, I've got a couple questions quick, but in the definition, I'm not an English major, and I don't mean to be create a problem here where there probably isn't one, but the definition provides that hair texture and hairstyles can be included in the trait. Okay. Let me just read it from here. Race means traits historically associated with race. So we have inside the definition, there's the word, and it just seems kind of ambiguous or obtuse. I don't know how exactly to. I understand part of it is symbolism, like you said, but I don't know. Can you address that? I just don't. I see that as a definition. If we're trying to define race, it's race means traits historically associated with race. So I don't know if you could address that.
Yeah. One quick point before you do, Representative Heinrich. Just so we're clear for the record,
yeah.
That the definition was amended by the amendment, so it now reads race is inclusive of traits associated with race.
Just okay, so it's kind of the same idea there, yeah. Mr. Chair, but yeah,
yes.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Freiberg, Representative, thank you very much for that question, and I appreciate the intentionality about language because words do matter. So this is not intending to define race. This is trying to be inclusive to make sure that the race is inclusive of traits associated with race. So I would look at that full statement together right there.
Representative Heinrich?
Let's move along. Thank you for that, Commissioner. My next question is in regards to when we're talking about dress codes. I know in my workplace, I work in the asphalt industry, and we have equipment and machinery that if somebody's hair is too long, it doesn't matter what their racial identity is. There are some standards that we have to have for workplace safety on the types of clothes that are worn. You know, if you have pants that are too baggy, they could get caught inside the paver equipment. You know, there's chains and moving things. I'm sure that that's across multiple industries. So how does this deal with making sure that we still protect those workplaces that are trying to implement safety standards as far as, you know, if your hair, again, no matter what your racial identity, if your hair could possibly get caught in a machine or something, I could see that worker being said, hey, you know, because of your safety or because of our standards here, we're going to have to change the, you know, you can't wear baggy pants like that and your hair can't be as long. We're afraid it might get caught in a machine, but, you know, just for one example. So how do we protect against so that it doesn't move right to, I was told to cut my hair, this must be a racial issue when it could be a workplace safety issue. Thank you.
Okay.
Commissioner Lucero.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. So I think we want to be really careful that what we're talking about right here are hairstyles inherent to racial identity. And hairstyles inherent to racial identity, like all of our hairstyles, can be tied up, can be put up. And so, you know, when you're talking about safety regulations, that's a different category than just categorically discriminating against hairstyles inherent to racial identity.
And I would agree that, you know, safety is paramount. I'm sorry, Chair Fiber. That safety is paramount in every industry.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think it's something as simple as when you go into any restaurant and someone has a hairnet on. I mean, those are practices that we want to ensure that are kept. But again, you know, in relationship to the commissioner, it's beyond that safety piece.
Yeah, and I can just add to, I just opened the statute here. This is in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. If you look to section 363A.08, unfair discriminatory practices relating to employment or unfair employment practice, the first, in subdivision one, the first statement there is, except when based on a bona fide occupational qualification, it is an unfair employment practice for a labor organization because of race and the other categories to deny equal membership and so forth. So it does have that exception in there for bona fide occupational qualifications, which I think your question gets to.
Thank you, Chair. So,
yes.
Yep. Representative Heinrich, any
questions? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you. Are there any other members who would like to have any questions? Okay. I'll just add thank you. I think this is a really important issue. Chair Moran, I really appreciate that you're carrying this bill, and I'm glad we're getting the opportunity to address it. Do you have any closing remarks?
Yeah, I'm just going to close with a letter that I received from Salacy's, forgot her first name, from her mother. And she's not a constituent of mine. She don't live in my district, but she wrote me. And she said, I want to say thank you for introducing this legislation. As a mother of a mixed-race child, I have seen them struggle with teachers and school officials making inappropriate comments about their hair. Also, my husband has been asked to shave his dreadlocks in order to be hired for a position on several occasions. She said that her daughter is part of youth in government, and she drafted a bill to end the discrimination of natural hair and presented it to her cohorts. You know, and this really is astounding that here we are in 2020, that many, she was surprised that many people was opposed to a bill that focused on hair. And what I realize is that when discrimination does not impact you and you live your world without being discriminated about whatever, you find difficulties in seeing why it needs to be done. And so this bill, and I hope that you have heard through the many stories that you heard before you, that discrimination is real. You know, we never want a child to feel not valued, that who they look and show up as is not important with their hairstyle, and nor is it and should be illegal for someone to be fired or removed from their job because of their natural hair. And so here we are today in the 21st century in Minnesota, codifying and including hairstyles, braids, and locks and twists to be inclusive so that no one will be discriminated for their hair and their natural beauty.
Thank you, Chair Moran. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 3103, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the next bill is House File 1346, Representative Kunesh Podin. While you situate yourself, I will move House File 1346. Be recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. I understand you have an author's amendment as well.
I do, Chair.
Okay. I will move the DE1 amendment to put the bill in the shape Representative Kunesh Podin would like. Is there any discussion? Okay. Okay, seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. Representative Kunesh Padin, would you like to describe the bill?
Yes, thank you, Chair and members. Matake Ape, I am happy to be here with all of you. I'd like to start this morning off with a land acknowledgement to acknowledge that and recognize that we Minnesotans reside on the traditional, ancestral, and contemporary lands of Indigenous people, and that this capital and this building are residing on lands that were ceded in the treaties of 1837 and 1851 from the Dakota. And we all can acknowledge that our state has very complex and layered history here. So I offer this land acknowledgement as one of the ways that we educate legislators and the staff and the visitors in our community about this land and our relationship to it and with it and with each other. As a Lakota descendant and state legislator, I invite all of you to commit to ongoing efforts to recognize, support, and advocate for American Indian nations and people. Today I would like to present to you House File 1346 that acknowledges the heritage languages of the Dakota and the Ojibwe nations and that they be recognized as Indigenous languages in the state of Minnesota. For our Indigenous people, languages not only identify their origin or their membership in their community, but it also carries their ethnical values, their ethic values, and their ancestors. The Indigenous knowledge systems that make them one with the land are so crucial to their survival and to the hopes and the aspirations of their youth. Minnesota's state of Indigenous languages, the Dakota and the Ojibwe, mirror the historic path of their ancestors. At one time, both the language and the people were on the verge of disappearance. The footprint of our Dakota people, past and present, is evident throughout Minnesota and has been the homeland of the Dakota people for thousands of years. According to the Dakota creation story, Dakota people and life began in Minnesota, and despite the disastrous history, our communities continue to claim this land as their home. Minnesota has four federally recognized Dakota communities in Minnesota: Prairie Island, Lower Sioux, Upper Sioux, and Shakopee, and we have one non-federally recognized community in Mendota. In 2002, it was estimated that there were about 400 Dakota people here in Dakota Indigenous people here in Minnesota, and only maybe 8 of them could speak their language. We also share this land with our Anishinaabe, our Ojibwe, and our Chippewa family members and relatives, the Boys Fort Band of Chippewa, the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, Red Lake Band of Chippewa, Grand Portage Band of Chippewa, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and White Earth. These ancestors of the Ojibwe lived throughout the northeastern part of North America and along the Atlantic coast. And due to a combination of prophecies where they were inspired to move west to find the land where the food grows on the water, that we know that as Manoman, as the wild rice, they arrived here in Minnesota, and our Dakota ancestors moved over, welcomed them, and we now live side by side. With a long history of systematic oppression and government assimilation policies that included the boarding schools, forced boarding schools, and Indian Relocation Act, our Dakota and Ojibwe communities have had to address a plethora of survival issues. Today we are here to recognize their Indigenous roots in this state long before the Europeans ever arrived. And so I would like to share this time, and I would invite those that have come to speak to this issue.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh Padin. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Arthur Lockwood. I'm a Prairie Island tribal member, and I teach Dakota language in the community. And I would like to share a history, a version of history by my family. If we go back, my family's oral history goes back 7 generations from myself. And when we go back, that far to my great, 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 great grandpa. In his story, we're not sure when he was born. But once we start getting one generation ahead of that to my great, great, great grandpa, Hushasha, Red Legs, he was born in the early 1800s, about 1805. He had a son, Thomas Whipple would be his Christian name. His Dakota name was Wakana. He was born about in the 1840s. After that point, then you get into the 1851, the treaty era. So he was born just before the treaty era and the move over to the Sioux Reservation in Minnesota. During this time, the reservation era, the treaty era, the official policy on Indian affairs was the only good Indian is a dead Indian. I'm sure we've all heard that term. I heard that term as a child and a teenager. But moving beyond that, my great-great-grandma, Helena Whipple was her Christian name. When we get to her era, so this is post-reservation, post-treaties, we get into the next official policy, which was kill the Indian, save the man. And, you know, you would say genocide on a people is detrimental to their race. But that genocide continued. I think technically it's still considered genocide, but I kind of coined the term with my students, culture side. When you get into this next era of kill the Indian, save the man, with the boarding school era, I'm sure we're all familiar with that. We've heard of that. My great-great-great-grandma, or my great-great-grandma, Lena Whipple, she was pretty much monolingual in Dakota. But her daughter was the first generation, my great-grandma, Lucille Childs. She was the first generation to go to boarding school. She was bilingual, Dakota and English. Then my grandma was the first generation in our family who was born who was not taught to speak Dakota. She, just as to solidify the matter, she was also sent to boarding school, even though she wasn't raised in her language. Then you get to my mom and myself. We weren't raised in Dakota, but as a child, my grandma's older sister, she was the last one in our family who could speak Dakota until myself. When we're raised in our communities with going to public schools, learning the American history, having this disassociation with ourselves, it can be very problematic for Dakota children to be raised and taught in an education system that teaches from a different perspective, teaches without our history. And forgive me if I go over a few seconds, but the thing that I want to touch on is that I relearned my language. I speak my language. I teach my language in my community in honor of my grandparents. And I only speak Dakota to my daughter. And hopefully she will be, you know, a next generation of teachers to bring it back when maybe we don't have any elders who can speak as a first language anymore. And so what I would stress, what I'd like to stress on the committee here would be not only to acknowledge Dakota language as a heritage language, that's the first step, but the only good Indian, or the kill the Indian, save the man, was a federal policy that was enforced by the states. The states, the police, the church, they came in and took my grandma out of her home and brought her to an Indian normalcy school to be taught how to be normal, to be taught how to be Christian. And I would like the committee and representatives from the state, you know, to have a broader discussion on how the state can support revitalizing the Dakota language. You know, it was a key role in removing the language from our homes. And I'd like the state to help revitalize that, bring that language back to our homes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lockwood. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name Nezhike Wasang and Dijnakaz, Migizi and Dudame, Miyama, Mississauga Gunning Wing Jabayan. For the record, my name is Bradley Harrington. That's my legal name. And I'm from the Eagle Clan of the Anishinaabe people, and I live and born and raised in the Mille Lacs Indian Reservation in central Minnesota. And much like my coda here, how he talked about the historical aspects of what happened to our languages, Ojibwe languages are the same, if not identical, to the stories of the Dakota people. And I would like to take my time to talk about how that applied to me today. So about 10 years ago, April of 2010, I was sitting in Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility in prison for the second time, serving a 5-year sentence for DUI. I had some type of awakening during this time and knew that if I pursued my identity as an Anishinaabe person, my life may be saved. I got out August 1st of 2012 and pursued my language and culture. I tried doing it from the back of the room because I was only after the language, but soon realized that the language was a lot more than just something to use here in the physical world. It is a sound and a set of syllables that not only resonates in a physical space, but connects here to the spiritual world, which gave me a lot more energy in order to deal with my addictions and criminality and lack of self-esteem that I was facing at the time. I then pursued to learn languages and the Ojibwe language in any way that I possibly can. I would take the classes, but along that time, I'd also go and speak with the elders. So I worked with 4 elderly Ojibwe men and was able to acquire enough language to where I was in college at the time studying natural resources, to where I had to make a critical decision on how I was going to pursue knowledge. I was, it was a midterms week, and one of the elders called me up and said to come help him out with a naming ceremony for a baby. I had to decline because it was midterms and I couldn't risk missing out. And coincidentally, the midterm was in mammalogy, and it was on the scientific name of small mammals. I was taking the test and wondered how this was going to help my people, how this knowledge was going to help me. I could be helping my elder, who has about 1,000 years worth of knowledge, and connecting a physical being to the spiritual world, but instead I was learning the scientific Latin name of a redback vole. And I have worked in natural resources since, and I have yet to use that knowledge. But carrying on, I did finish a semester, and I haven't went back. And that was 2016. I have pursued nothing but an Ojibwe language, culture, history, ended up in federal Indian law. But one of the biggest parts of it now is I have found a purpose in life. I have found an identity that I'm still looking to fit the puzzle pieces together and combine it on how I can best serve the Anishinaabe people and also the state of Minnesota. At one point in time, Ojibwe language, you could not live in this area without knowing the Ojibwe language, as it was the lingua facta, the commerce language of the Great Lakes, which ultimately led to great relationships and a booming economy, which brought 2 countries to war. So it is a very powerful physical language, but overlooking the spiritual part of it, us over in the northern part of Minnesota count our blessings as how we are able to maintain our lives today, and some of us conquer our addictions It is through prayers of today combined with the prayers of 1,000 years for my people through the language. So it is a very strong and powerful way of being. It is a very strong and powerful connection human-wise, but then also I can ask for my good graces, and because of that, I'm able to say in April of this year, I will have 11 years clean and sober. Miigwech.
Congratulations. Thank you, Mr. Harrington. I have Shannon Geshek on the list of testifiers. Welcome to the committee. If you could please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Shannon Geshek. I am the executive director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, and I actually wanted to donate my time of testimony to these two powerful stories. But I will quickly say that this bill was a one of my grad school projects. In my former role at the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, I oversaw the Dakota and Ojibwe language grants appropriated from the Legacy Fund. And in that, and prior, I do not speak my language fluently. I would love to learn, and I'm it's in motion. I think it'll be a lifelong learning experience for me. I think the most important thing that I can add to the testimony that hasn't already really been stated is that Dakota and Representative Kunesh Podin did indicate this earlier, excuse me. But I do really want to emphasize that this is a shared history. By acknowledging, and this bill is a simple acknowledgement. So by acknowledging the Dakota and Ojibwe, you're also acknowledging your history, non-Indian history in the state of Minnesota. Miigwech, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Geshek. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1346? Seeing none, is there any member discussion? Ranking Member Kwam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the amended language better. I am somewhat curious. I know there are, I'm not sure if you'd better to say dialect or some other indigenous languages, and I didn't understand why you might go the full list, because
the full list, Chair, a full, are we talking about the 11 tribes, or the full list of what?
Representative Kwan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's been some correspondence, and that my understanding is that amongst the 11 tribes, there would be additional, and I'm not sure if they're standalone or more of a dialect or a regional.
Okay.
And that was more of a curiosity, and I assume that there have been energetic discussions on it. I just was curious on the topic.
Chair
Kwam, are you referring to we received an email last night, I think, that referenced some?
There were other things I'd heard before. And so, you know, I'm not an expert on it. I just didn't know if there were, I assumed that, you know, centuries ago there were some migratory activities and et cetera. And so I was just curious if that was looked at as being more of a general thing, because if, well.
Yeah, Representative Kunesh Padin.
I'm vaguely familiar with the email or the letter that you got, that you all received the other night. But if you look at the Dakota Nations or the dialect, there are other dialects under the umbrella of the Dakota. So you have Dakota, Lakota, Nakota. Dakota are mostly the Minnesota Dakota speakers. Nakota are mostly the ones that are in northern North Dakota and Montana and into Canada, and if I'm wrong, please correct me. And then the Lakota are the South Dakota, little bit of North Dakota speakers, and that's my family standing rock. And so we could list every single different dialect, but it's sort of with our English, you know, we all have accents from where we came from. Are we going to say Southern Minnesota, Northern Minnesota, which are very different dialects. And so as the indigenous communities originating they're the naturally occurring ancestors of this place, we chose the Dakota and the Ojibwe. And if Ms. Gishik would like to add anything to that.
Ms. Gishik?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the only thing that I would add to that is that the Dakota and Ojibwe people have established tribal nations here in the state of Minnesota, too.
Representative Paul? Well, thank you, and I just wanted the discussion as you know, shown that we did talk about it, and I know that I work on a lot of international things, and there's English, American, there's British is different. And Spanish, the hemisphere is over here versus Spain. So there are differences, and I wanted to make sure that we covered that. And Maguich.
Thank you, Representative Plum. Representative Gomez.
I think that the Representative Kunesh Pudin kind of covered it, but just kind of about the email that we received, you know, certainly, like in the district that I represent, there are dozens of members of tribal descendants or members of tribal communities from around the country. But just that this effort is really about, you know, to Mr. Lockwood's point, the state of Minnesota intentionally and violently separated the indigenous communities of Minnesota from their culture and language. And so, you know, when we look at the millions of dollars that are in the legacy bill that attempt to support the revitalization efforts of those communities, right, that are federally recognized here, that there's a government-to-government relationship with, like between our state and those tribal governments, that this is really about that effort. And I'm just glad that we're staying. I wouldn't want us to not be focused on the our responsibility as representatives of the state that historically has done this damage and now has an obligation to make efforts to repair it. I wouldn't want us to get that kind of confused in saying, oh, well, there are like a lot of you know, different indigenous groups here. Like there is a particular reason that it's Dakota and Ojibwe that you kind of heard our testifiers talk about. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Representative Lehman.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I don't know. I think I'm just looking for clarification of the information that we have is that there's no fiscal impact to this.
No.
This is a symbolic that's very meaningful to the Dakota and Ojibwe people, but there's no cost to the state of Minnesota. To do this, or to local communities.
Representative Kunesh Pudin.
Thank you, Chair. No, there is no cost, but I do want to remind, and many of us that have been here for a short time, back in 2011, there was a legislative working group on the Dakota and Ojibwe language revitalization and preservation. And there's a really great report that came out of this. And one of the outcomes that came at the end of this in a verbal way was an acknowledgement of the work that was done to eradicate the language and the forced assimilation of our native communities, and then working together with our tribal nations, our indigenous folks, to preserve that language and then to revitalize it. And this is one more step towards completing that study back in 2011.
Representative Lehman?
That answers my question. Thank you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Kudish Prodeen. Probably one of the last few times you'll be crossing the street over to that fancy building. No, sorry, I got to tease you a little. But no, this is a great bill that you have before us, and thank you for doing that. And you've been a leader on on these issues. And I just happen to be chair of Legacy right now, and we've got other chairs, and I'm happy to hear you mention that that you were helping with that. It's kind of neat to see where the money actually goes. And so all of us as a body with the Legacy bill, and I'm chair, but it's all of us passed. And so there's, in the last biennium, there's $3.5 million that went into languages.
Yep.
And then the biennium before, which Representative Lehman, I think, was vice chair then, and had $2.6 million for language. But I think what you're saying is that, it's fixing wounds and mm-hmm. those sort of things and recreating. But I appreciate the effort, and I'm glad that you brought it forward. And but all of us have made a commitment through Legacy, certainly, because I think most of you have voted for it, and it helps with your cause too, I think. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Any additional member comments or questions? Seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Kunesh-Podein?
Thank you, Chair. Well, I think we've heard this morning, especially from these gentlemen and from Ms. Gieschik, how important language is, not to just our identity, but also to our health and our wellness, how languages speak to our mind and our bodies and our soul. And I think it's really most important with our American Indian communities, not just here in Minnesota, but across the way. And I certainly believe that this renewal of Native languages is tied to increasing our community strength and identity and wellness. And so this is also a way to show the tenaciousness of our Native communities. And I would request, Chair, that you would move this House File 1346 on to the General Register. Huapula Tonka, Che Miigwech, and thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kunesh-Podein. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1346, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 18th. Seeing if there's any other questions? Seeing none, I will adjourn the meeting. Thank you, members.